Dr. Ignaz Semmelweis was the deputy director of obstetrics at Vienna's General Hospital during the mid-19th century. The hospital had two maternity clinics. The first of these two had a high mortality rate among the mothers. Semmelweis learned that the first one was served by medical students, whereas the second one, with a lower mortality rate, was served by midwives. At first, Semmelweis could find no other differences between the two clinics, but then he dug deeper. He discovered that the medical students who served the hospital routinely went into the basement first and practiced surgery on cadavers. Then they went right away up into the maternity clinic to serve the expectant mothers. Semmelweis saw the connection because these students did not wash their hands. So he ordered them to wash their hands. In fact, he gave them a specific solution, what today we would call a disinfectant, made out of chlorinated lime. And so they began to wash their hands after they had worked on the cadavers, but before they went up into the maternity clinic. The mortality rate dropped 90% almost immediately, and within 4 months was nearly zero. Surprisingly, the medical world was not at all pleased with this. Many doctors were offended at the idea. They were being told to wash their hands. Wash my hands? They thought Semmelweis was crazy. He was committed to an asylum, and within 14 days, was dead. It would be years before Semmelweis would be vindicated by the work of Louis Pasteur confirming the germ theory, and also a man by the name of Joseph Lister, who took the French microbiologist's research to heart and practiced and operated using hygienic methods and did so with great success. And today, no serious medical professional would discount hygienic methods in their practice. This is the consequence of Semmelweis' vindication and the implications of the evidence. ...2,000 years ago, Jesus of Nazareth said he had been sent by God for the redemption of the world. People thought he was crazy, or worse, he was arrested and killed. But within 3 days, he was seen alive again. Apparently, God really did send him. The resurrection is Jesus' vindication. And it would be foolish to ignore the implications. But how do we know the resurrection took place? Couldn't it have been a fabricated story, a legend? Luke gives us several pieces of evidence that point to a real historical event. Early in the morning, on the first day of the week, certain women came to the tomb where Jesus had been laid. Now, if we were to say this story today, we might say something like 39 hours later, from 3 p.m. on Friday to 6 a.m. on Sunday. We have to understand that in the Hebrew culture, part of a day was reckoned as a day, and that the day began at sunset. So the scriptures are correct when they tell us that Jesus was in the tomb 3 days. Many of the same women who courageously witnessed Jesus' gruesome crucifixion planned to assist the family in finalizing the body for burial. And Jewish custom allowed such women to work with either gender. They would take things like aromatic oils and spices to be placed within the burial cloths. Now, Jesus had indicated to his followers that after his death, he would be resurrected, but they really had no idea what he meant when he said that. So it came as quite a shock for Mary Magdalene and the other women to discover that the tomb where Jesus had been laid was empty. But it also would have been a shock to the first readers of Luke's account. Shocked that the initial witnesses of the resurrection were women. I've mentioned on previous occasions that women had a low standing in ancient Judea. They could not give testimony in either Roman or Jewish courts of law. If Luke was making this whole thing up, then why include women as the first witnesses? It would have done nothing but undermine the plausibility of the account to the first readers. The only possible explanation for Luke saying that the women were the first witnesses is because that's what actually happened. Luke also names names. He mentions Mary Magdalene, Joanna, and Mary, the mother of James. Earlier, he identified Simon of Cyrene, who was forced to carry that cross beam to the place where Jesus was executed. And then later, he mentions Cleopas. The naming of names is significant. In ancient times, names were like footnotes for a historical account. Luke, the historian, is challenging his readers. Talk to these people. They're still around. Check it out and see if it isn't so. I was a religion major in college. The religion faculty, including the college chaplain, did not have a lot in common with mainstream Christianity, a characteristic even more prevalent in today's colleges and universities. We were taught that the resurrection did not take place. Stories about a resurrection were fabricated, were created by the disciples for the purpose of capturing the symbolic feelings they were experiencing. Yes, Jesus was dead, but somehow he was still with them. They made up stories to give voice to higher truths, stories that remind us that spring always follows winter, and so we'll always have hope. All right, but if you read Luke 24, okay, even just on a first impression, basic level, it won't take long before you get through the story and you realize this explanation is a load of hooey. What does it say? It says, "Look at my hands and my feet and see that it is I myself. Touch me and see, for a ghost does not have flesh and bones as you see that I have." And when Jesus had said this, he showed them his hands and his feet. While in their joy, they were disbelieving and still wondering, he said to them, "Have you anything here to eat?" They gave him a piece of broiled fish, and he took it and ate it in their presence. So what is the higher truth that is being symbolized here? What aspiration is capturing our imaginations and sending our souls deeper into the mysterious spirituality of it all? Here's the answer. Jesus is having fish and chips with his friends. Say what? Jesus is having fish and chips with his friends. What kind of symbolic truth is that? The thing is, there is a higher truth here. But it is scandalously concrete. Jesus is saying, "I'm not a symbol. I'm really here. Have you anything to eat?" Now, this is not the way to write a legend. Jesus' request for something to eat seems trivial, almost silly. So why is it here? Well, because that's what happened. This is what the eyewitnesses heard and saw. The resurrection is not a myth, not a legend. It's not a cliche to brighten someone's day. It happened. One of the most persuasive arguments that Christ did indeed rise from the dead is the effect it had on his followers, both then and now. What was it that changed a frightened and cowardly band of disciples? And they were a frightened and cowardly band, not some cool, calm, and collected philosopher poets who decided to make up some stories to make people feel better. What could change such frightened and timid people to people of conviction and courage? What was it that changed Peter from one night, the night before the crucifixion, denying three times that he even knew the man, from that into a roaring lion of faith? Now, 7 weeks later, some 50 days later, Peter risked his life by saying that he had seen the risen Jesus. It must be remembered that he gave his electric Pentecost sermon in Jerusalem, where the events had taken place, and in the one place in all the world most antagonistic to his claims. This wasn't in Galilee, miles away, where no one could check the facts, where Peter's ringing statements would ring hollow and no one would bother to challenge them. No. This was in Jerusalem. And that change in Peter and his friends can only be explained if the resurrection really did take place. And there is the evidence of the resurrection that is contemporary and personal. If Jesus Christ rose from the dead, then he's alive today and ready to enter and change the lives of those who invite him in. Millions now living bear uniform witness that the resurrected Christ has transformed their lives. Are you one of them? It seems to me that in light of all this, you have four choices. You can choose to ignore the facts. After all, we live in a Facebook culture. Truth is determined by likes and dislikes. Who needs facts? There are people who hold to the opinion that Jesus was merely an ancient religious teacher and nothing more. And no amount of objective data to the contrary can ever change their minds. They remind me of the professor in Alfred Hitchcock's classic, The Lady Vanishes. Upon being confronted with the fact that the evidence refuted his theory, replies, "Nonsense! My theory is perfectly correct. It is the facts that are misleading." But the facts concerning Jesus Christ are not misleading. They lead to an inescapable conclusion that Jesus is who he claims to be, the very Son of God. Who do you know in history has said, "My enemies are going to kill me, but within 3 days I will be alive again," and actually pulled it off? I know of only one. And until someone else comes along and duplicates what Jesus did, I'm banking everything on the fact that he's the one we need to pay attention to. He's the one we need to follow. The second choice that you can make, to some extent, the second choice is actually worse than the first. It is to like the Easter story, but not take it too seriously. It is to treat the resurrection of Christ much the same way we treat stories about a rabbit who hides eggs. A nice bit of wonderfulness that we have fun with once a year. One of my all-time favorite worship bulletin typos comes from a congregation in Indiana. I know what they were trying to say, but this is how it read. "This being Easter, we will ask Mrs. Johnson to come forward and lay an egg on the altar." Now, I dare say, if Mrs. Johnson were capable of such a feat, that would be a remarkable thing to see. But it's hardly in the same league as the real Easter story. A naked and bloodied Savior, suffering and dying for the likes of you and me. No, Easter is not a nice, likable story. It is either a damnable lie responsible for the delusion and ultimate death of millions of people, Or it is the most profound truth we can ever know, with eternal consequences. The third choice would be to say, okay, look, Jeff, I just can't take your word for this. I'm going to investigate this myself. And if that's your choice, my response would be an enthusiastic, go for it. You would not be the first, and you will not be the last person to do such. Lee Strobel was an award-winning journalist with the Chicago Tribune and an atheist. But he was challenged to conduct an investigation, a personal investigation into the evidence for Jesus. And as a result of his intensive investigation, he came to the conclusion that Jesus did indeed rise from the dead, that he is the Son of God. And he compiled his investigation into a book called The Case for Christ. And I recommend it to you, The Case for Christ by Lee Strobel. The fourth choice you could make. The fourth choice is to accept the truth that Jesus did indeed rise from the dead. And he's alive and he's knowable today, even now. Now, there may be some of you who have never made this choice before, and I would hope and pray that you would do so. In prayer, admit your need for God. Believe Jesus died for you and was raised from the dead. And commit yourself to Christ personally as your Lord and Savior. And acknowledge that commitment as you live your life. Admit. Believe. Commit. Jesus said, I am the resurrection and the life. Those who believe in me, even though they die, yet shall they live. And those who live and believe in me shall never die. Thanks be to God.